Soldiers scurried from Ali Nassar's path, focusing on erecting temporary living quarters, servicing vehicles, and preparing weapons. They were mounting a counter-terrorism operation against a top ISIS leader across the border in Iraq. It was likely that Nassar's assistant had called ahead to warn the base commander of his mood, and that it would be best to give the Saudi intelligence chief a wide berth. Nassar was still in a rage about what had happened in Rabat. Talal bin Musaid had been tasked with the simplest of endeavors, but he hadn't been able to do even that. Instead, this meaningless pup had jeopardized everything Nassar had accomplished over the past 6 months. He could feel the men's gaze on him as he walked along the dirt road, their eyes shining with admiration and desert sun. The fact that he had been chosen to replace Prince Khaled bin Abdullah as the head of the General Intelligence Directorate was all but unheard of, and gave each of these soldiers the hope that they too could rise above their common berths. Prior to Nassar's promotion, high government positions had typically been held by royals. The exception was the Energy Ministry, which the king quietly acknowledged was too important to trust to one of the half-wits that made up the House of Saud. Now, though, the forces of radical Islam were massing at the gates, threatening not only the common man, but the monarchs who lorded over them. With his family no longer immune to the danger posed by the jihadists they'd created, King Faisal had decided that a certain level of competence would be required to maintain order. An improbably young man in a colonel's uniform appeared from a tent, and instead of attempting to avoid Nassar, rushed to meet him. Mahir Bazi had recently been promoted to lead Saudi Arabia's special forces. While insufferably eager and loyal, he was wholly unqualified for the position. King Faisal had felt obligated to reward the man for his role in saving Saudi Arabia's oil fields from an attack orchestrated by ISIS. The fact that Bazi was likely complicit in the murder of his predecessor by Mitch Rapp was something the king was apparently willing to overlook. "Director Nassar," the man said, stopping to give a crisp salute. "It's a pleasure to see you, sir. Are you aware that the king is on his way here?" Nassar had been informed of that fact only an hour ago, and despite the efforts of his staff, was still in the dark as to why. The aging monarch rarely left the walls of his palace anymore. What matter could be urgent enough for him to venture out into the world that he had become so fearful of? "His Highness and I have matters to discuss, and this was a convenient time and location," Nassar said, being careful to hide his contempt for the young colonel. He was a tepid Muslim, with little guile or ambition beyond simple service to his king and country. Nassar's people had found nothing with which to blackmail him, and he would likely be immune to offers of money, women, or power. That, combined with the fact that he'd gained the king's favor, made him a man to be rid of at the earliest opportunity. Fortunately, that opportunity was about to present itself. "Is everything ready?" Nassar asked as jet engines became audible to the east. He didn't bother to look, confident that the source of the sound was Faisal's Airbus A380. Despite being only an hour's drive from Riyadh, the geriatric fool had flown, undoubtedly out of fear of leaving the lavish ministrations of his wives and doctors. "Yes, sir. Intelligence has confirmed that General Al-Amri is en route slightly ahead of schedule."
"Will that be a problem?"
Bazi shook his head. "I was prepared for variations in our timetable. We'll be wheels up a half hour earlier than planned, but it won't affect any of the other operational parameters." Nassar gave a barely perceptible nod. Dabir al-Amri was near the top of ISIS's command structure. Before the invasion of Iraq, he had been one of Saddam Hussein's most talented young officers, and now he was adding his strategic genius to Mullah Sayyid Halabi's messianic charisma. Capturing him would be a devastating blow to the terrorist group, and a service that Colonel Bazi was anxious to perform for his beloved king. "I have every confidence in you," Nassar started.
but I've decided to personally oversee this operation.
But, sir,
the General will be traveling with a significant security force. There's no way I can guarantee your safety. Please allow...
I understand.
Neither I nor the King hold you responsible for my safety. He forced a smile and clapped the younger man on the shoulder. I think you'll find my men quite useful, and I assure you that I can take care of myself.
The Airbus passing overhead drowned out Bazzi's response, and Nassar began walking toward the runway, feeling his sense of agitation increase with every step.
If anything, he had been overcautious in his efforts to undermine the authority of the country's monarchy. Was it possible that his actions had been discovered? The likelihood seemed remote. But even if the king had unwittingly stumbled upon some faint trail, nothing would lead to Nassar personally.
Still, the damage to his plans could be considerable.
A group of soldiers double-timed a set of steps to the plane, and Nassar climbed them as one of Faisal's security men opened the door. He stepped aside and bowed his head respectfully.
His Highness is waiting for you at the back, Director.
Nassar passed through the opulent interior and found King Faisal sitting alone on a sectional sofa near the rear bulkhead. There was an oxygen mask next to him, but the tank it was attached to was tastefully hidden. 86 years of life and hundreds of thousands of American cigarettes had left the man with emphysema and congestive heart failure. But as near as Nassar's people could tell, maddeningly free of cancer.
It's my understanding that preparations for tomorrow's operation are proceeding acceptably, Faisal said, dispensing with the formalities he'd reveled in as a younger man. With so few breaths left, he now tried to use them wisely.
This is my understanding as well, Your Highness.
I also hear that you've decided to involve yourself personally.
You are indeed well informed.
Do you think it's wise?
The risk to me is minimal, and the importance of this operation can't be overstated. If we move quickly, the capture or assassination of Mullah Halabi is within the realm of possibility.
Is that something that we would handle ourselves?
No, Highness. I think it would be much wiser to have the Americans take the lead.
Faisal nodded, his blue-hued lips pursed into a perceptible frown.
It had been the king's strategy for decades. Let the West protect his privilege while he quietly undermined them.
It wouldn't work for much longer, though, and Faisal knew this better than anyone. He was one of the smartest royals, and had the impressive distinction of being perhaps the most selfish. He saw the growing power of the jihadists and understood the horrors that a confrontation would bring. He just wanted to make sure that confrontation didn't occur until he was gone.
And what of the other matter?
You're referring to Thalaba.
You know I am.
Thalaba was a Saudi blogger who despised the monarchy and was becoming increasingly bold in airing that distaste.
It's an issue we're still studying, Excellency.
Studying? If Khalid was still in charge of our intelligence efforts, this problem would have been resolved long ago.
It was hard to argue the point. Prince Khalid, in addition to being a complete idiot, had been almost comically heavy-handed. He liked to make an example of anyone who defied the royal family with a public trial and an even more public execution. Unfortunately, with every agitator killed, 1,000 more were created.
May I remind you that this is precisely why you found it necessary to remove Khalid, Your Highness? Any overt action against Thalaba will only martyr him. News of his death will spread across social media like wildfire, consuming everyone who reads it.
But he's associated with ISIS, Faisal protested. And you tell me there's nothing we can do?
The old fool was incapable of understanding the world that had grown up around him.
Affiliations were fluid at best, meaningless marketing declarations at worst. ISIS was as much an idea as an organization, an idea that was infecting Saudi Arabia's youth like it had the youth of Iraq and Syria, an idea that would soon overwhelm everything. Discretion is why you hired me, Your Majesty, and so that your family could be insulated from these things.
What about the Americans?
They won't act against Thalaba. Freedom of speech is one of their most dearly held values. Faisal finally reached for his oxygen mask and continued to stare at his intelligence chief while gulping from it. With falling oil prices, he could no longer provide sufficient entitlements to keep his people docile. They were beginning to turn on him, fueled by the fanaticism beat into them by the Wahhabi madrasas he'd built to blind them. His relationship with the West was all that stood between him and his own people. Unfortunately, the Americans had begun to tire of spending billions supporting a country that was anathema to everything they stood for. Worse, terrorism was becoming more important to them than oil, and Saudi Arabia was among the largest exporters of both. ISIS could be defeated. It was a trivial matter, really. But the idea that it represented would not be so easily vanquished. With ISIS gone, what would fill the vacuum left behind? History had answered this question countless times. Eventually, extremist forces had their day. The only question was whether Saudi Arabia would lead those forces or be consumed by them. The king removed his oxygen mask and allowed his withered frame to sink deeper into the sofa.
The President of the United States has demanded a meeting with our ambassador. No information has been provided as to the reason. This is unprecedented. Do you have any thoughts as to what would prompt such a request?
None whatsoever, Nassar said. But his mind immediately went to Prince bin Musaid's actions in Morocco.
The ambassador is quite worried. He believes that the lack of an agenda is intentional, that they don't want to give him the ability to prepare.
It seemed obvious to the point of being self-evident. But then Saudi Arabia's ambassador to America was a drooling moron. Unfortunately, he was also King Faisal's cousin.
Would you like me to attend that meeting, Your Highness?
The king smiled.
I assumed that you would resist, Ali.
Normally, he would have. But if there was any chance that the Americans had information on what had happened in Rabat, it would be unwise to let the ambassador go alone to that meeting.
I am yours to command, as always, Nassar said. You've never met President Alexander, have you?
No, Highness. For a man in his position, he had met very few Americans, something that was by design and not chance.
He hated their arrogance, their obsession with peace and money.
They had traded the privilege of serving their God for order, comfort, and pleasure. President Joshua Alexander took this one step further. He had been attacking the Saudi way of life since he was a young politician, trying to transform the kingdom into a modern, secular blend of Eastern and Western values, to force the followers of Allah to make the same bargain with the devil that his own countrymen had.
Perhaps this would be a good time.
It would be my honor, Your Highness. Faisal nodded regally.
Success in your action against General Al-Amri should be enough to put us in a position of strength with regard to the Americans.
He covered his mouth with the mask again. His next words were muffled, but still intelligible.
Yes, Al-Amri's head will keep the Americans docile for a bit longer.
Chapter 11. East of Manassas, Virginia, USA. And that, Irene Kennedy said, pointing to a partially completed stone dome. The afternoon had turned warm, and the sky was marred by only a few white clouds to the east. Claudia had just mowed the lawn with a John Deere tractor that was her new favorite possession, and the scent of freshly cut grass still hung in the air. Pizza oven, I think. Kennedy took an austere sip of her wine, trying to hide her smile.
What?
Most of us would have bet against Mitch Rapp ever owning a pizza oven. Maybe I'm less of a one-trick pony than you thought. Her smile broadened.
The house is magnificent, Mitch. So is the location. I can see why you chose it.
There are still a few lots left, if you're interested. I think I could convince Stephen to give you half off. 50 cents.
She shook her head. Thank you. But I'm a city girl at heart. I'll just hope you invite me back.
Rat nodded and took a less austere pull on his beer. In some ways, they had become like siblings. Despite that, they rarely saw each other outside of work. Their lives were in a constant state of chaos, and the normal things that normal people did tended to get lost in it. Even now, the reason she and her teenage son were there wasn't because of him. It was because of Claudia. He heard Anna walk up behind him and felt a tug on his pants leg.
Can I take Tommy to see the barn?
He glanced at Kennedy, but she turned away, pretending to examine the landscaping. His reflex was to tell Anna to ask her mother, but he fought it. Kennedy was testing him.
Sure.
But there's still a lot of construction equipment in there, and I don't want you to get anywhere near it, okay?
She grinned, and then looked up at Kennedy. Mom wants me to ask you if you want another glass of wine.
No, thank you, dear. One's my limit.
With that, Anna sprinted toward Kennedy's son, who was standing in front of the sculpture near the gate, studying it with a slightly cocked head.
Tommy, Rapp shouted, you're in charge. Don't do anything that'll make me want to snap your neck.
The teen gave him two thumbs up and jogged toward the gate, playfully nudging at Anna as she ran. Kennedy watched them start up the road, not speaking again until they disappeared into the trees.
Terrifying, aren't they? I make life or death decisions every day, and more often than not, it's Tommy that I lie awake at night worrying about.
Yeah. I'm not sure I'm doing a very good job making the transition.
Really?
My understanding is that you're doing a wonderful job.
Did Claudia tell you that?
Her only answer was another dainty sip from her wine glass. What's happening with the little prince? Rapp said, changing the subject to one he was more comfortable with.
The president's called a meeting with the Saudi ambassador.
You're not going to get anything from that idiot. No one tells him anything.
I agree.
But I understand that he's bringing Ali Nassar along.
The new intelligence chief?
Interesting. Have you dealt with him yet?
Not personally.
But I can tell you he's very different from his predecessor. Strong, intelligent, and ambitious. Is that better than Khalid's stupid, radical, and misogynistic? Or is it worse?
Having a counterpart like Nassar in Saudi Arabia could be very helpful. Or it could be very dangerous.
Unfortunately, where the Middle East is concerned, it's usually the latter. I've been included in the meeting, so I'll be able to give you a better assessment after.
And what's the tone of this meeting going to be?
She considered her response for a moment.
The president's angry.
In fact, this may be as angry as I've ever seen him.
Rapp could very much sympathize.
The redacted 28 pages from the report that detailed Saudi involvement in 9/11 was only the tip of the iceberg. The agency had been told to bury everything else they'd found on the subject. King Faisal had been left to handle the many co-conspirators in his government as he saw fit. Stability and the flow of oil were preserved, but it was a decision that Rapp had been violently opposed to. At the time, though, he'd been a young operative with very little to say about decisions at that level.
And do you feel the same, Irene?
Angry?
Yes.
But I'd be surprised if Faisal knows anything about his nephew's activities.
Even you have to admit that after 9/11, the Saudi government has been an imperfect but reasonably cooperative partner in the war against terrorism.
Faisal's on his last leg, though, Rapp said. The man spends most of his time holed up in his palace with oxygen tubes up his nose.
She nodded thoughtfully.
He'll be gone soon, and we'll have a whole new set of challenges to deal with.
That's for another day, though. The question we have to answer now is whether Rabat was an isolated incident, or whether there's a greater conspiracy. The people looking to fill the vacuum Faisal's death creates may also be looking to generate closer ties with the young radicals gaining power in the region.
Maybe I made a mistake, Irene. Maybe I should have let ISIS irradiate Faisal's shithole of a country.
How many times are we going to have to go through this with them? We let them off the hook for the most deadly terrorist attack in U.S. history, and now here we are again. It's starting to sound like a broken record.
You didn't make a mistake.
We still have a significant amount of influence on the Saudis, and letting the country fall to ISIS would have been a disaster.
Sometimes I wonder. Every day it seems to get worse.
It may be that we have to let it all burn down before we can rebuild it.
Possibly. But I don't think we're there quite yet, Mitch. I still see a few rays of hope.
You must have better eyesight than I do. So you think you'll actually be able to resolve anything in the meeting with Nassar?
Probably not.
I assume the Saudis will just deny everything, and we don't have much in the way of hard evidence. It would have been convenient if we'd actually captured bin Musayyid.
She fell silent, but kept looking directly at him.
Go ahead, Irene. Say it.
Okay, I will. You need to replace Scott. Not forever. Just until he's fit for duty again.
I heard he's thinking about splitting his job into operations and logistics. That's an intriguing idea.
As if on cue, Claudia appeared from the front of the house, holding a fresh beer for him. She handed it over and smiled warmly.
Dinner will be about another half hour. So, what are we talking about?
Chapter 12. Central Iraq.
Ironically, the house had once been the property of a U.S. contractor charged with the hopeless task of rebuilding Iraq. America's politicians had once again made the mistake of judging this part of the world by their own standard. They believed that the natural state of humanity was justice, and that it would reign if the pockets of wickedness were eradicated. In truth, the natural state of humanity was chaos. The Americans had just managed to hold it at bay over most of their short history. Colonel Mahir Bazi crawled forward to get a better view of the property. The compound was constructed of stone and ancient beams, built into the cliff behind it. Trees sprouted in front of the stacked rock perimeter wall, and vines clung to the gray stone, nearly obscuring it. Through the haze of his night vision scope, the property looked abandoned, but it was just an illusion created to ward off American drones. Bazi swept his scope right and spotted a man creeping up on the empty space where a gate had once been. Four additional armed men were angling in from the north, and two more, invisible from his current position, would be coming in from the east. None were from his teams, though. They all belonged to Ali Nassar. Bazi had protested to the king, but it had been pointless. Faisal had become a man of compromise in his twilight years. While Bazi remained in command of the assault, Nassar's elite ops team would carry it out. It was true that Nassar treated him with respect, but Bazi was fully aware that it was only a pretense created to please the king. Nassar dismissed him as inexperienced and hated him for his history of cooperation with the Americans. Further, Nassar believed that he had witnessed and covered up Mitch Rapp's killing of Saudi Arabia's former special operations commander. These suspicions, far from suggesting that Nassar was paranoid, were just another example of his competence. All were in fact true. While the American government was hopeless, Mitch Rapp had an encyclopedic knowledge of the Middle East and what had to be done to tame it. There was evidence that finally, with so many failures behind them, the politicians were starting to listen to him. As Bazzi saw it, this was the only hope for his country. Left to the backstabbing machinations of Faisal's successors, the kingdom would descend into an endless civil war that would wipe it from the map. Nassar, while unquestionably a force of nature, was a fundamentally twisted man. A man of all-consuming ambition and an almost sociopathic lack of patriotism. While he had managed to convince the king of his fealty, it was clear that he cared nothing for the man, the kingdom he ruled, or his 30 million subjects. And so Bazzi found himself adopting the uncharacteristic strategy of leading from behind. As little as he trusted Ali Nassar, he trusted Nassar's men even less. The team was finally in position, and Bazzi was about to authorize the assault, but it turned out to be unnecessary. They began without his order. He watched them flood into the compound, losing sight of most as they fanned out behind the wall. The muffled crack of suppressed assault rifles was joined by the undisciplined growl of fully automatic weapons, as General Al-Amri's men tried to resist the incursion. Bazzi started down the loose slope, forcing himself to keep an unconscionably slow pace. His normal practice was to run toward battle, but he suspected that his survival depended on reining in that instinct. In fact, he would have preferred to be relieved of his duties with regard to this operation. But such a request would have been an insult to the king. The gunfire fell silent when he was still 50 meters from the wall, and he activated his throat mic. "Has the courtyard been secured?" There was no response. "I repeat, has the—" "It's secure," came the curt response. Bazzi moved through the gap in the wall cautiously, scanning the moonlit courtyard. Nassar's men were in evidence on all sides, having taken control of every strategic position. The bodies of 3 armed men were face down in the dirt. "Any injuries?" "None." The sound of machine gun fire erupted to Bazzi's right, and he dove headlong to the ground, rolling into a position that allowed him to swing his Heckler & Koch G36 toward muzzle flashes, coming from a stand of trees 15 meters away. He depressed the trigger and felt the buck of his weapon as he returned fire. A shadowy figure burst from cover, using the eruptions of dust created by his bullets to refine his aim. The impacts made it to within 5 centimeters of Bazzi, before he managed to hit the man in the chest and spin him into an ancient well. The silence descended again, and he searched the darkness, seeing no one but Nassar's men looking down at him. None had fired a single shot. It was clear that his continued existence depended on learning a whole new set of survival skills. He was no longer a simple special forces captain. He was a favorite of the king, and as such, a reluctant player in the power struggle that was to come. Bazzi moved toward the men gathering at the front door of the massive house. Again, he hung back, waiting for them to enter before he followed. They needed to move quickly. There would be more security men inside, and all would be running for defensible positions. Nassar's team couldn't afford to get bogged down. They needed to get General Al-Amri on a chopper before ISIS reinforcements arrived. He kept Nassar's men in front of him, but doubted they would do anything overt. Allowing one of General Al-Amri's men to kill him was very different than doing the job themselves. One day it might come to that, as Nassar continued to push against the limitations of his low birth. But for now it was unlikely that he was prepared to murder the head of Saudi Arabia's special forces. They continued down the hallway, coming to a set of stairs that demanded a split in their forces. It was obvious that he wasn't really in command, so he didn't bother to give orders. He wished that he could just retreat back outside of the wall. but King Faisal would want a detailed description of the operation. His duty was clear, and he carried it out, choosing to follow the men who continued along the ground floor and letting the other team take the steps. A sudden flash to their right was followed by the ear-splitting shockwave of a grenade. The two lead men crumpled as the two behind them began trading fire with an assailant or assailants in a room ahead. Bazzi instinctively sprinted up behind them, sliding on his hip toward the downed men. One had been hit in the neck by shrapnel and was trying unsuccessfully to speak through blood-spattered lips. Despite his relative youth, Bazzi had seen men in a similar condition before. He wouldn't live. The other man was still down, but his flak jacket had taken most of the shrapnel. Bazzi dragged him to an empty room, keeping watch behind him more for Nassar's men than Al-Amri's. It was a situation where friendly fire casualties could be easily explained away. There was a second door in the room, and he shoved it open, checking the hallway before slipping into it alone. The sound of gunfire continued, increasingly muffled as he cleared the rooms lining the passage. Most consisted of nothing but four stone walls, but the last two were arranged with opulent bedroom furniture. Finally, he arrived at a locked door near the back. Nassar's men were still pinned down behind him, and he fired at the latch, deciding he'd rather go in alone than with backup hand-picked by Saudi Arabia's intelligence chief. Bazzi stood to the side and gave the door a gentle push. A moment later, three shots sounded, passing harmlessly by and hitting the wall on the other side of the hallway. He risked a quick glance inside and was able to make out detail from the moonlight coming through an unshuttered window. The furniture was even more grandiose than in the prior rooms, and the space was much more expansive, probably 10 meters square. The shooter had taken cover behind a bed and seemed to be armed with a handgun. Almost certainly, the general making a last attempt to protect himself and his family.
"Surrender, General. If you do, I promise your wife and children will not be harmed."
Two more shots came through the open doorway, and Bazzi slipped his weapon around the jamb, firing a short burst into the bed's dense wood frame.
"Come in here where I can see you, Saudi coward."
Bazzi pulled back.
"Be reasonable, General. You think I'll let you take me? If you force me to kill you, your family will be interrogated in your place. What kind of man would allow this to happen?"
Bazzi slipped his weapon around the door jamb again, this time sighting over it. Al-Amri held his fire. Muffled whispers were audible behind the bed, and he finally tossed the gun onto the mattress and stood with his hands in the air.
"I have him," Bazzi said into his radio.
The shooting at the other end of the hall had stopped, and he could hear the sound of booted feet running toward him. A moment later, Nassar's men had surrounded Al-Amri and his family.
"Bind them and bring them into the courtyard," Bazzi said. "I'll call in the helicopter."
"Understood," Ali Nassar said. "ETA less than 1 minute." The operation had gone reasonably well. Al-Amri and his family had been secured without injury, and at the cost of only one of his men. Bazzi had survived, which was suboptimal, but having him die during the assault was less critical than it would have been convenient. The young military commander would just have to be dealt with more directly. The pilot switched on a spotlight, and Nassar could see Al-Amri's compound below. The only place flat enough to land was the courtyard, and the pilot sat down inside the walls, kicking up a dense cloud of dust that enveloped the young colonel running crouched toward the aircraft. He stopped short when he saw Nassar jump out, his gaze flicking from the intelligence director's face to the suitcase in his hand.
"Director Nassar, what are you doing here? I was told that we were to bring Al-Amri to Medina."
"There has been a change of plans," Nassar said. "We'll begin our interrogation here."
"Sir, this location isn't secure. By now the locals will be aware of our presence."
"But that's precisely the problem, isn't it, Colonel?
News that we've captured Al-Amri will travel quickly, and any intelligence he provides us will become useless at the same rate. If we have any hope of finding the whereabouts of Mullah Halabi quickly enough to take him, it will have to happen here. He paused. If you're frightened, I can arrange for my helicopter to take you to a safer location.
That won't be necessary, Bazzi said,
leaving off the requisite sir as an act of pointless defiance. May I carry your case? Nassar gave it to him, smiling imperceptibly as the man moved off with what he undoubtedly assumed were the implements necessary to extract information from their captive. Nassar followed the young officer through the building and into a back bedroom, where General Al-Amri was secured to a chair. His wife and children were huddled in a corner. Take his family outside, Nassar ordered. Two of his men ushered them out, and another two remained, keeping their guns trained on the helpless Iraqi.
Ali Nassar, the man said, and then spat on the floor. What brings you this far from your comfortable home? And who will lick King Faisal's ass while you're gone?
Your reputation for bravado is well earned, I see. As is your reputation for drama. Nassar drew his firearm and aimed it at Al-Amri's head. The general stared back defiantly while the increasingly nervous Colonel Bazzi looked on.
Sir, I need clarification. I was told that we were to get this man and his family back to Saudi Arabia. I understand that time is of the essence, but we're in danger here, and if we're attacked, we risk not getting any intelligence at all.
Nassar nodded silently, and then adjusted his aim, firing a single round into Bazzi's forehead. The man collapsed onto the stone floor, a dark pool of blood fanning out around his head. Nassar fired a second shot, hitting the dead man in the thigh and then another in the neck. It would make the precision of the kill shot easier to explain away. Cut the general loose and leave us, Nassar said, holstering his weapon. One of his men severed the flex cuffs holding Al-Amri, and then he and his comrade disappeared down the hallway.
What is this? The general said, too confused even to stand.
Nassar gazed down at the man who could legitimately be described as his ISIS counterpart. Al-Amri was hardly a brilliant man, but he didn't need to be. That was Mullah Halabi's role, and it was one he filled well. Al-Amri needed only to be competent enough to carry out the mullah's orders, and indeed he had proved to be more than up to the task. The combination of the two men was extraordinarily dangerous, more so than even the vaunted Irene Kennedy understood.
We both know that the Saudi royalty won't survive the death of King Faisal, General. He's refused to groom a successor, and the government will collapse under the weight of the power struggle. The Americans know that the royals in line are cretins, and it's unlikely that they'll support any of the candidates. That's why you're here, to tell me things I already know.
I'm here because the rise of a caliphate that spans the Middle East is inevitable, and I believe that ISIS has an excellent chance of being the organization that ushers in that era. The mullah's plans display great wisdom and vision.
Really?
Al-Amri said, his voice gaining strength. And what are those plans, Ali? ISIS will eventually succeed in a massive attack on the U.S., and you will use that to turn the American population against its Muslim countrymen. As they are increasingly marginalized, ghettoized, and persecuted, they will rise up. This will continue the trend of America turning inward. Combined with their increased energy production, they will come to the realization that they have no compelling strategic interest in the Middle East anymore. They'll withdraw, and Mullah Halabi will be free to take control of the entire Islamic world.
Very clever, Al-Amri said, but enough with speeches. You want something?
Of course,
Nassar responded. Your recent attack on Saudi Arabia would have destroyed the country's oil supply, and with it, the country itself. This was unwise. We have unparalleled military, intelligence, and financial resources. In fact, I think you recently enjoyed the fruits of the latter through the efforts of Prince bin Musaid. You were behind that? Did you really think that an idiot like bin Musaid could have initiated something like that on his own? I have an extensive network of royals and wealthy private citizens sympathetic to your cause, and I'm willing to coordinate their efforts to help you. The king will discover what you're doing and execute you. The king will do nothing but die. You'll kill him. Nassar shook his head. The years are doing it for me. And what do you want in return? That's something for me and Mullah Halabi to discuss face to face. Nassar opened the suitcase, enjoying the general's expression when he saw the euros stacked inside. I'd like you to deliver my request for a meeting along with this gift. And if I refuse? On the surface, it seemed like an odd question from a man in his position. But it was expected. He would reasonably see Nassar as a threat, as a man with far greater training, intellect, and resources than he himself had. And while taking the general's place might become necessary in the future, it made sense to allay Al-Amri's fears for the time being. I believe that you and I can work very effectively together, General. Me, from Saudi Arabia, and you, at Mullah Halabi's side.
Chapter 13. Langley, Virginia, USA. Rapp pulled into the underground parking lot at CIA headquarters and briefly slammed the charger's accelerator to the floor. The engine was powerful enough to shove him back into the racing seat, but incapable of drowning out Radiohead's new album. He would never admit it to Craig Baylor, but the car actually had been worth the wait. The sound system was as good as any he'd ever heard. The armor's reduction in weight was immediately noticeable, and the annoying turbo lag was gone. Finding something to complain about was going to be a challenge. He blasted by a few startled men in business suits before slamming on the stellar brakes and turning onto a ramp that led deeper into the garage. As was his custom, he passed by his assigned space and selected one at random. State-of-the-art armor or no, there was no way in hell he was going to park in a space with his name stenciled on it. He jogged across the asphalt and slipped into a private elevator, leaning against the back wall as it ferried him to the 7th floor. Normally he avoided Langley like the plague, but Mike Nash was pretty much glued to his office these days. He'd become Irene Kennedy's go-to for dealing with Congress and the press, making it difficult for him to stray far from the Beltway for more than a few hours at a time. Besides, if Rapp had stayed home, he would have gotten roped into talking to Claudia about Coleman's job.
I hear the Iraq op went off without too many problems, the former Marine said when Rapp entered his office.
Rapp dropped into a chair and put his feet up on Nash's desk. But not so much Rabat.
Yeah, Maz is back stateside, but he's lying low. Scott and I both told him you're over it, but he won't listen. He needs to hear it from you.
Nash was forever playing the diplomat. In this case, though, he was probably right. I'll call him on my way home. That seemed to satisfy him, and he pulled a folder from his drawer. The purpose of this meeting wasn't to talk about Joe Maslick, but to find a temporary replacement for Coleman on the ops side. Rapp wasn't particularly optimistic, but it was something he was going to have to face. Sitting around and hoping for Coleman to miraculously heal wasn't working out.
I think we've put together some solid candidates, Nash said.
The hint of nervousness in his voice suggested that he wasn't sure Rapp would agree. Go ahead.
Let's kick it off with Gary Fielder.
The guy with brain damage?
It's not brain damage, Mitch. He has a congenital neurological condition that makes it impossible for him to feel fear. It's a thing. People have written papers about it.
No.
That's it?
No?
Gary's a solid operator with years of combat experience.
I can anticipate what a brave soldier will do in a given situation, Rapp said. But someone who can't even conceptualize fear? Unpredictable.
But move on.
Fine. You don't want Gary? Forget Gary.
Anthony Staton.
How old is that guy?
Not as old as Scott.
Weren't his hips shot?
Got a replacement. You're still due for a knee.
Rapp shook his head.
I've got nothing but respect for Tony.
But you've picked the only guy on the planet who's full of more lead than me.
I figured you'd say that, but it was worth a shot. Pun intended.
Here's an out-of-the-box one. The Japanese said they'd lend us Yoshi. Don't tell me that guy isn't solid.
He eats nails, Rapp agreed. But I can only understand about half of what he says, and that goes to 10% when he's on a radio.
Nash let out a long breath and shuffled through the folder for a few seconds.
So I'm not going to be able to sell you Chet Washington?
No.
Or Seth?
Hell no.
Brandon Trett?
No.
Nash closed the file.
I get the feeling you're doing this to me on purpose.
If Scott's replacement fucks up, you'll be fine, but I'll be dead.
Okay, fair enough.
What would you say if I told you I have an operator who's so good that even you'd steer around him if you had the chance? Rudimentary Arabic, but pretty well connected in the region. And as a bonus, he's easy to get along with and speaks fluent Russian.
I'd say you have my attention.
Grisha Azarov.
Rapp just stared at him, not sure he'd heard right.
You want me to replace Scott with the man who did this to him?
Nash held his hands up in a plea for peace.
Not my idea, Mitch. That name came straight from Scott. He's worried about you, and he's worried about his guys. Figures Azarov's the best.
So that's all you've got?
Pretty much, yeah.
Rapp pushed himself straighter in his chair.
Maslik's a good man. His first command was a little rocky, but none of us could say ours went much better. He'll get his feet under him.
He's going to quit, Mitch. I'm telling you, if you put him in charge again, he's going to walk.
I'll talk to him.
What about logistics?
We haven't worked on it.
What do you mean?
Why not?
You already know the answer to that, man. Scott wants Claudia. Irene wants Claudia. And Claudia wants Claudia. You might be picking up a pattern here. A certain name that keeps coming up.
She isn't getting involved.
Then we've just managed to get absolutely nowhere.
I'll convince Maz to take the ops job and you'll get me some names for logistics.
I'd rather not, Mitch. If I do, Claudia's going to find out, and then she's going to tell my wife and I'm going to catch hell.
Rapp started for the door.
I don't give a shit what you'd rather not do, and I don't give a shit what Irene thinks. You and Scott have 48 hours to get me that list.
Chapter 14. The White House, Washington, D.C., USA. When Irene Kennedy entered the Oval Office, President Alexander was looking through the window at the sunlit landscape beyond. Normally, he would have turned to greet her, displaying the southern hospitality that he was famous for. Today, he didn't acknowledge her at all. For a politician, Alexander was a surprisingly reasonable and honorable man. His opponents tried to use his good looks and dimpled million-dollar smile to paint him as naive and weak. Those accusations couldn't be further from the truth. He was an extremely intelligent and pragmatic man who cared deeply about his country. Like everyone in his position, he occasionally did the wrong thing for political reasons, but at least he did it reluctantly and with a strong grasp of the consequences.
The American people would be shocked to know that their affable leader's greatest flaw wasn't naivete or weakness. It was rage. Instead of brief flashes of anger or occasional sarcasm to blow off steam, he bottled it up and eventually exploded. Kennedy had never spoken directly to the man about it, but the topic had once come up at a cocktail party she'd attended with the president's aging mother. According to her, he'd been that way since he was a toddler. Kennedy took a seat in front of his desk. As always, a steaming cup of tea was waiting for her on a side table. "Good afternoon, Mr. President." He didn't respond, undoubtedly preoccupied with the meeting he was about to host. Of all the problems he had to deal with, Saudi Arabia was perhaps the one he despised most. It was a country with sufficient resources to provide prosperous lives for its citizens and be a force for good throughout the region. Instead, those resources had been used to enrich a handful of monarchs and to promote the cycle of violence and misery that the Middle East was currently mired in. There were enough horrifying problems facing the world without having to spend blood and treasure trying to deal with the self-inflicted ones. When the president finally took a seat, he wore the relaxed smile the world was so familiar with. "Irene, a rare pleasure. You seem to be sending Mike Nash to deal with us politicians these days." Alexander was fond of ribbing the people who worked for him, but there was always a serious side to his jokes. A response was always required, and it was best if it was an honest one. "He's good at it, sir." Alexander nodded. "Watch out for him, Irene. I don't think he wants your chair, but I wouldn't be surprised if one day he's sitting in mine." Her eyebrows rose slightly. It wasn't something she'd ever considered, but now that she thought about it, Alexander was right. He always was when it came to politics. "I'm certain I'd enjoy working for him almost as much as I've enjoyed working for you." That was her subtle dig. Alexander hated to be patronized. "Stop buttering me up, Irene. I already feel like a turkey about to get shoved in the oven." She reached for her tea, relieved that the level of tension had diminished slightly. "Did you hear that the ambassadors begged off?" Alexander said. "Some bullshit story about having food poisoning. So we're just getting Nassar." "I'm not entirely surprised, sir. Calling an emergency meeting with no clear agenda is going to worry King Faisal. And he's aware that Ambassador Alawad is..." Her voice faded for a moment. "Less than capable."
"He's a mental defective. But my understanding is that Ali Nassar isn't. What do we know about him?"
"He's a former army officer with a significant amount of combat experience. He was educated at Oxford as part of a scholarship program King Faisal put into place for the exceptional children of working-class Saudis. In his early 30s, he moved from the military to Saudi intelligence, where he's enjoyed a distinguished career, culminating with him replacing Prince Khaled as the head of the General Intelligence Directorate."
"Religious?"
"He had a strict Muslim upbringing and gives every impression of maintaining those beliefs. Having said that, he's also practical and ambitious, so it's hard to determine how much of his religious conviction is real and how much is just a reflection of what's expected."
"Another politician in the making."
"Possibly."
Alexander leaned back in his chair and appraised her for a moment. "I'm suspicious about them suddenly flying Nassar in for this meeting. Do they know about Prince bin Musaid's visit to Morocco? Do they suspect that we tracked him there?"
"I don't think we should jump to conclusions," Kennedy said. "Right now, all evidence suggests that King Faisal has lived up to his post-9/11 agreement with us. We're not seeing any pattern of government-sponsored terrorism or support coming from the royal family."
"Until now."
"Yes, sir. But Prince bin Musaid is hardly a member of the power elite. I'd categorize him more as a black sheep."
"So a disgruntled little prick who doesn't think he's getting his due is lashing out?"
"Until we have evidence to the contrary,"
It makes sense to assume that's the case. You're always the voice of reason, Irene. I don't know how you do it.
I've always been an optimist, sir.
He actually laughed at that. The levity didn't last long, though. His secretary poked her head in and announced the arrival of Ali Nassar. Send him in. Kennedy had never been in the same room with the Saudi, but now she had to admit that he was an impressive figure. Probably 6'2", with the square shoulders and narrow waist of a soldier, despite being in his early 60s. His beard was dark and neatly trimmed, topped with close-cropped hair graying at the temples. He smiled politely and reached for the president's hand.
It's a great honor, sir. Please allow me to apologize on behalf of Ambassador Al-Awad for his absence. He's quite ill.
Let me know if there's anything I can do.
That won't be necessary. Your country's excellent medical personnel have things well in hand.
His accent was more British than Middle Eastern, the result of his years studying in England.
When Alexander released his hand, Nassar turned toward Kennedy.
Dr. Kennedy, after speaking so many times on the telephone, it's a pleasure to finally meet you in person.
I'm glad you happened to be coming our way, Director Nassar.
His dark eyes flashed almost imperceptibly at her words. They both knew very well that the timing of his trip was no accident.
Have a seat, Alexander said. Nassar selected a leather wing-back chair and watched silently as Kennedy and the president took up positions adjacent.
I don't see any reason to beat around the bush, Alexander said. We have information that Prince Talal bin Musaid recently went to Morocco to provide $1 million in cash to an ISIS representative.
Kennedy watched the man's reaction carefully. For a moment, there was none at all. Clearly, he was calculating how to respond. The question was whether he had been aware of bin Musaid's actions, or if this was a complete surprise. To his credit, she was unable to determine that from his expression.
I'm sorry, Mr. President, but I find that difficult to believe. Who gave you this information?
We had a team there with orders to capture the man delivering the payment.
Are you saying you have the prince in custody?
It was a surprising question. Obviously, Nassar would know if the king's nephew had disappeared in Morocco. In light of that, it came off as a bit of a taunt. The president didn't react. So maybe Kennedy was in luck. Maybe he missed it. Our team was concerned that taking him could create an international incident and made the decision to stand down.
Then I don't understand. Is this just speculation? Because our government and our royalty are as dedicated to the war on terrorism as anyone in the world, and that war has been extremely effective.
Like your recent operation against General Al-Amri? That quashed her hope that Alexander had missed Nassar's provocation.
Our operation went flawlessly, Nassar responded. Unfortunately, Al-Amri wasn't there.
Alexander turned toward her.
Is that our understanding, Irene?
This was a dangerous and unnecessary game of brinksmanship. One she didn't want to be dragged into.
The intelligence on the general's location was accurate, she said.
And yet, I was there, Nassar countered.
It seems likely that your intelligence was flawed. I think we would both agree that this is hardly uncommon where the Middle East is concerned.
He hadn't bothered to veil that insult.
Certainty is difficult to come by, she said before the president could rejoin the conversation. The anger was visible in his eyes, and he needed a moment to gain control of it. I believe that your accusation against Prince bin Musaid is an example of that lack of certainty, Nassar said. Who were these witnesses? Private contractors in your employ? These men are little more than mercenaries, and as such have very little credibility. Do you have any actual evidence to present?
We have a photograph, she said.
Really? And is this photograph conclusive?
It was clear that no photograph would be considered conclusive by this man. Certainly not one taken through a scope in marginal light.